Hello, this is Rusty Gaffney, and you're listening to Pinafore Live. Today, the featured issue is the first issue published in Volume 7 and the first issue to be posted on the new Principino website, which debuted on September 5th, 2008. There are two topics of interest in this issue. The first one, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Prince's style. In other words, how do I critique wines, and what is my preferred style of wine? And then we'll move on for a discussion of an extensive tasting of cult Pinot Noir collectibles. Now, with regards to style and preference, as you know, we all genetically have disparate palates, and therefore no two people taste wines exactly the same way. The wines that are reviewed and recommended in the Pinofile are really only a starting point for your own exploration of Pinot Noir. Like any wine critic, I have my biases in my preferred style. But I do appreciate all styles of Pinot Noir, and I welcome diversity. I like to use the analogy of a suit maker. You may engage a suit maker to craft a fine suit for your personal configuration. When finished, the suit may not fit perfectly, but if the suit is well made and the craftsmanship is evident, you can still admire it. Similarly with wine, a Pinot Noir may not conform to your personal stylistic taste, but you can admire the winemaking skill reflected in the finished product. It is senseless to disparage wines you personally do not like. You may like peas, for example, while others hate them. I disdain blue cheese, and my wife adores it. I want to lead you on the path of discovery, but not do the discovery for you. You have to explore, experiment, and find out what is magical for yourself. Mine is but one opinion, admittedly based on quite a bit of experience, but not infallible or certainly almighty. A prince I might be, but I don't rule the world of Pinot Noir. I say, explore the kingdom, revel in the diversity. Now, finding good Pinot Noir today is not that difficult. Consistency and excellence have never been better. Falling in love with Pinot Noir is easy to do, but as Kathleen Francisco has pointed out, a tempestuous love affair it will be. This is because Pinot Noir changes in the glass from minute to minute. It is a chameleon, altering its aromas and flavors in the bottle from day to day, week to week. It can be showy one day, shy and withdrawn the next, and is never exactly the same. You have to be a patient suitor, able to welcome all the faces of Pinot Noir. The best advice I can give you is to get to know the producers and winemakers and develop a bond with them. Establish a loyalty for and an insight into the wine you are drinking, and you will amplify your drinking experience. Don't expect the same wine every vintage, and relish in the spirit and character each year brings. Remember, it is the same composer, but never the same song. Now, most of you who read the Pinofile regularly will not find the following information a surprise. Here are my personal stylistic preferences in Pinot Noir. I look first for balance. Alcohol, acid, tannins, and fruit, all in harmony. I prefer complex aromas with no alcohol intrusion and complementary oak. I delight in lively acidity. I am seduced by soft, velvety textures. I am impressed by wines that gain power and interest in the glass over time. I like wines that show well the next day from an open bottle, indicating they will age very well. I prefer wines that are food-friendly, because I like to drink wine with my meals. I like refreshing and juicy wines that make you want to take another sip. I prefer wines that are around 13.5% to 14.5% alcohol. I can drink more without getting sideways, and these wines stand more on the grape than on the sweetness of the alcohol. I find lighter colored wines more to my fancy. Somehow they seem more appropriate for Pinot Noir. I prefer elegance and finesse the calling card of fine Pinot Noir. Wines that are lacy and delicate, but hit you like a revelation. Sexy, but in a slightly rough and erotic way. I really like wines that leave you searching for words. As winemaker Veronique Drouin of Domaine Drouin in Oregon stated so eloquently, there are lots of good wines in the world that give you pleasure. A great wine gives you emotion. I usually taste wines in flights of 6 to 8 in the morning when my palate is fresh in a quiet and peaceful setting. I use Riedel Vinum Burgundy glasses or Riedel Oregon Pinot Noir glasses only. The wines are opened at cellar temperature, 55 to 60 degrees. I do several passes through the wines over 90 minutes, spitting along the way. I then swallow some of each wine. If the wine still seems closed, I will resample it in the evening or recork it and taste it the next day. I often retaste the better wines with food at lunch or dinner. I will taste a second bottle if there is any question about the integrity of the bottle opened, if a second bottle is available. I do not taste blind for the most part, relying on my personal integrity to honestly report my findings. To commemorate and celebrate the launch of the new Pinophile and my new Prince of Pinot website, I had a few friends join me, and we blind tasted a baker's dozen of cult California and Oregon Pinot Noirs from recent vintages. These so-called cult wines have been the subject of many disparaging titles, such as Monuments to Elitism, Toys for Millionaires, and so forth. But they still remain of great interest to Pinot Noir lovers. Almost impossible to find, absurdly priced on the secondary market, and more often sold on the auction market than consumed, these wines still remain the standard against which many other Pinot Noirs are measured. I'm just briefly going to go through each of the wines and give you a little background information about them and a few comments about the impressions I had. The wines were tasted in the following order, which is alphabetical. I can say, generally speaking, with regard to these wines, they were all certainly well-crafted. Shy and delicate, they weren't. Several were quite high in alcohol. Generally, they displayed highly concentrated fruit with dark fruit aromas and flavors predominating. They were well-muscled, strikingly sculpted, and truly Olympian in stature. It's easy to understand how wines like these could score well in tasting panels because their flashiness can easily seduce. The top wine, the gold medal wine, was the 2005 Ponzi Abatina Vineyard Willamette Valley Pinot Noir, which only barely edged out the 2004 J. Rocchioli West Block Russian River Valley Pinot Noir, the 2005 Rocco Private Stash Willamette Valley Pinot Noir, and the 2002 Sine Qua Non Hollering M Shea Vineyard Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. The prices that I will quote on the wines are either winery release prices when known or current price on the secondary market. First of all, let's talk briefly about Aubert. That's A-U-B-E-R-T. Marc Aubert has a distinguished winemaking career, including a number of years at the helm at Peter Michael. His father was a pharmacist, and he made Petit Sirah and Cabernet at home. Marc became interested in wine and graduated from Fresno State with a degree in enology, with minors in chemistry and viticulture. He struck up a friendship with Helen Turley, who was consulting with Peter Michael. And when the assistant winemaker at Peter Michael departed, Helen hired Marc. In the year 2000, Marc left Peter Michael to become the winemaker for Kogan, again replacing Helen Turley. At the same time, he started his own label, Aubert Wines. He bought a 7-acre Chardonnay vineyard in the Vine Hill area near Forestville, which he called Lauren Vineyard, and nearby planted another 6 acres of Chardonnay and 1.5 acres of Pinot Noir, the so-called Ruling, R-E-U-L-I-N-G, vineyard. The budwood for the ruling vineyard is from a famous source in Volnay, Romani. Think DRC. He currently makes 4 vineyard designate Chardonnays and 2 Pinot Noirs from the ruling vineyard and the UV or Ulysses Valdez vineyard. Both Pinot Noirs come from the Sonoma Coast Appellation. Aubert is a fan of Burgundy. He loves Dujac, Jair, Laroy, and Mio Camazé. Who doesn't? His Pinot Noirs are made in very small quantities, around 100 cases, and they are sold only by invitation through a mailing list. The 2005 Aubert Ruling Vineyard Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir was sampled. The alcohol is 15.6%, and the release price was $80. This is a massive wine. Concentrated, mouth-coating flavors of plum reduction sauce, blackberry jam, cola, sassafras. Syrupy and smooth in texture with a long, opulent finish. It really is more about generosity and fruit than classiness and complexity. It might be a bit over the top for some, and it might be other people's perfect cup of tea. The second wine came from J. Rocchioli Vineyards and Winery in the Russian River Valley. The colorful Rocchioli story has been well told in a number of publications, including The Pinophile. The first viable Pinot Noir crop from the Rocchioli Ranch was in 1971. In 1976, Joe made 1,000 cases of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay at Davis Bynum under the Fenton Acres label. In 1979, he sold some West Block Pinot Noir to William Salem, who subsequently made it quite famous. Gary Farrell, the winemaker at Davis Bynum, made 50 cases of Rocchioli Pinot Noir from West Block and Allen Vineyard, and this launched his Gary Farrell label. That was in 1982. In that same year, Gary Farrell made 150 cases of Pinot Noir for Rocchioli, and this started the Rocchioli brand. Shortly after this, Joe's son Tom returned from the business world, disenchanted with his job, and joined the farm. He used his business acumen to build a 10,000-case winery, which was constructed on the estate in 1985. The name was changed to J. Rocchioli Winery. Tom soon took over the winemaking chores as well. The single vineyard and block designated wines are sold through a mailing list and are quite difficult to obtain. The Rocchioli Russian River Valley Pinot Noir, some of the Chardonnays and the Sauvignon Blanc are also sold through the tasting room, and they have some retail and restaurant distribution. Total production is about 13,000 cases of the 3 varietals. The 2004 J. Rocchioli West Block Russian River Valley Pinot Noir was outstanding. Alcohol 14.2%, release price $75. This had a wonderful sweet-scented smell of spiced black cherries and strawberries. It was ripe and juicy, had vivid earth-tinged black cherry fruit, and great persistence on the finish. Very delicious, very seductive, impeccably balanced, refreshing acidity, all you could ask for from a Pinot Noir. Highly recommended. The third winery is Kistler. Now, is there another winery in California that's been so successful without any marketing whatsoever, no public relations to speak of, no public tastings, no tasting room, absolutely nothing to suggest the owners have any interest in their consumer base? Robert Parker Jr. is one of the privileged few to be able to taste Kistler's wines, and he has anointed them as royalty. This is not to say the wines are not worthy. The Chardonnays go through 100% MLF and come out the other side very buttery and appealing, although their greatest attribute is as a sipping wine and not a food-friendly wine. The Pinot Noirs in the early years of production were highly extracted and heavily oaked, appealing to Parker's palate, but off-putting to many others, especially considering the high prices that were demanded. The winemaking style for the Pinot Noirs has mellowed in recent years to the benefit of the wines. Not much is revealed publicly about the winery, but production probably is around 25,000 cases of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay annually. Almost all the wine is sold through a mailing list in which the wine is allocated on the basis of years of customer loyalty and volume of customer buys. These wines are pretty much for only the well-to-do, as they started about $70 a bottle and go up significantly from there. We tasted the 2004 Kistler Cuvée Catherine Occidental Station Vineyard Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir. Alcohol 14.1%, 1,000 cases produced, release price $90. I think we probably had an off bottle. It was definitely the least appealing wine in the entire lineup. The fruit seemed muted. We had several tasters verify there was no TCA. The aromas were green beans and faint berries, flavors of simple dark red fruits, lively acidity, certainly a decent tasting wine, but nothing of cult caliber. I'll have to revisit that wine in the future. The next producer is Kosta Browne. Now, the story of Kosta Browne has been well told in the Pinot File, and I won't go into a lot of detail. Basically, Michael Browne and Dan Kosta met at a famous Sonoma County restaurant called John Ash & Company, where they worked as wait staff and wine management staff. They decided to make some wine, started putting their tip money in a cookie jar until they had raised about $2,600, bought some Pinot Noir grapes, a single barrel, and they were on their way. Things went slowly for a number of years. Michael Browne worked at Deerfield Ranch Winery and learned the business and learned winemaking. They were able to team with some investors who provided a business plan. And then the 2003 vintage was highly regarded by wine writer James Lauby of the Wine Spectator. And he awarded all of the 2003 Kosta Browne Pinot Noirs scores ranging from 90 to 96. It wasn't long before the mailing list filled up and Kosta Browne was on every Pinophile's radar. Currently, Kosta Browne has found a home in the old vacuum-dry apple processing plant in Sebastopol. Here they produce about 10,500 cases of single vineyard Pinot Noir and two Appalachian Pinot Noirs from the Russian River Valley and Sonoma Coast. The Pinot Noirs tend to be highly flavorful and intensely fruity wines, and the vineyard sources are outstanding. We tasted the 2005 Kosta Browne Kanzler Vineyard, Russian River Valley, Pinot Noir, alcohol 15.3%, 500 cases produced, price $62. This is a beautiful wine with plenty of sweet, ripe blue and black fruit wrapped in oak, sturdy on the palate with fine and firm tannins, yet showing some finesse and exhibiting a huge, clean finish that leaves a little heat in its wake. The next producer was Markussen. Markussen is probably the ultimate Pinot Noir California cult wine, demanding the highest prices on the domestic secondary market in the range of $300 to $350 or more per bottle. Helen Turley is one of the most influential winemakers in California, receiving critical acclaim for almost every wine she has produced. She has been the consulting winemaker for some of the best wineries in the country, including Peter Michael, Colgan, Bryant Family, and Martinelli, just to name a few. Markussen is Turley's own label, owned in partnership with her husband, John Wettlaufer. Markussen is the French word for young wild boar. She does not have her own winery. She crafts the wines at the Martinelli Winery in the Russian River Valley. Her 10-acre estate vineyard, Markussen Vineyard, is located in the Sonoma Coast and is planted half and half to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Fruit for the other vineyard-designated wines is sourced from other neighboring true Sonoma Coast vineyards, including Blue Slide Ridge and Three Sisters. The winery is quite private, and not much information is forthcoming. Turley is said to plant her vineyard very densely. She severely limits yields and picks very ripe. In her winemaking, she uses natural yeasts, new oak, and leaves the wines on the lees after fermentation. Stylistically, the wines are big and extracted with notable sweetness reflecting generous alcohol. She produces about 100 barrels of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, enough for 2,500 cases. The wines are sold to a mailing list which has been full for years. The waiting list is rumored to contain over 5,000 names. So your only chance really to try Margeson wines is to purchase them on the secondary market. We sampled the 2003 Margeson Blue Slide Ridge Vineyard, Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir, alcohol 14.9%, current retail price listed as $150 to $595, depending on the retailer. Very ripe, prodigious black fruits touched by oak, stems, mushroom, earth, citrus, and some noticeable alcohol. The tannins are reined in, and the mouthfeel was quite dreamy. Good, but not exceptional, because of the boozy impression that lingers. The next producer was Pisoni Vineyards and Winery. Now, wine grower Gary Pisoni comes from generations of farmers who tended row crops long before he was born. When he was in college, he developed an interest in fine French wines. And when he graduated, he was eager to find a way into the wine business. When he told his father he wanted to plant grapevines on the family cattle ranch in the Santa Lucia Highlands, he was met with a number of objections, not the least of which was the cost. Gary countered to his father, "Have you ever been to a $250 lettuce tasting?" His father relented, and a legendary vineyard was born in 1982. Gary Pisoni has now become a household name among Pinot Noir circles. He planted his own rooted vines in virgin soil. It's said that the vines came from suitcase cuttings from a famous domain in Vonnet, Romanée, and it's now called the Pisoni clone or selection. Winemaker's son Jeff Pisoni and grape grower's son Mark Pisoni created the Pisoni label, releasing the first estate Pinot Noir in 1998. A second label, Lucia, debuted in 2000. Pisoni fruit quickly became highly prized in California, and the Pisoni vineyard put Santa Lucia Highlands on the map, becoming one of California's true cult vineyards. The Pisoni estate Pinot Noir is sold exclusively through a mailing list. The Lucia wines are made in larger quantities and are available both through a mailing list and retail distribution. We tasted the 2005 Pisoni Estate Santa Lucia Highlands Pinot Noir at 14.3% alcohol, release price $65. Production numbers around 600 cases. This was the darkest wine in the lineup. It really was a showy wine, terrific aromatics, perfectly ripe blackberries, cranberries, and a smoky accent. Peppery, earth-kissed, delicious red fruits, refined but noticeable tannins, and a dry finish. This really delivers a bolt of fruit flavor. The next winery is Ponzi Vineyards in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Dick and Nancy Ponzi established Ponzi Vineyards in 1970 in Beaverton, Oregon, 15 miles southwest of Portland. Both Dick and his wife have been active in promoting Oregon's wine industry for years, and they are considered among the founding fathers of the modern Willamette Valley Pinot Noir industry. Ponzi Vineyards is one of Oregon's top 20 Oregon wineries by brand and has an estimated case production of close to 30,000. The wines have won many critical acclaims through the years. They've always been intense, savory, and concentrated. And consistency has been a hallmark, even during uneven vintages. My personal Oregon wine epiphany was a 1992 Ponzi Reserve Pinot Noir made from a single vineyard that was 18 years old at the time. And I've continued to buy and enjoy the Ponzi Reserve bottlings every year since. This is a family operation. The three Ponzi children, Michelle, Anna Marie, and Luisa, all work in the business, with Luisa being the winemaker. She is married to highly respected winemaker Eric Hammaker, who has his own label, Hammaker Wines, in nearby Carlton. A new Ponzi winemaking facility is due to be completed for this 2008 harvest. It's located in the Chehalem Mountains and is quite an impressive facility. We tasted the 2005 Ponzi Abatina Vineyard Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. 13.5% alcohol, 100 cases made, $100 in an etched bottle. The Abatina Vineyard is a two-acre plot established in 1975 and planted to 20 different Pinot Noir clones. The grapes from this vineyard are often put into the Ponzi Reserve bottling, and a separate vineyard designate is only made in exceptional vintages. This was the clear winner of the tasting. Redolent with both red and black spice cherries along with dried herbs and sprinkled with cinnamon, this wine is plush, supple, and delicious. There are some unresolved tannins, but they are fine and sweet. This wine charms with its discreet, concentrated fruit. A striking wine that is truly in a class by itself and deserves the word cult in front of it. Limited production, very, very high quality. The next wine tasted came from Privé Vineyard in the Willamette Valley. Mark and Tina Hammond handcraft their Pinot Noirs from 2 acres of estate vines planted in 1980 in the Chehalem Mountains. He meticulously manages the vineyard, and she crafts the wines in a tiny garage-sized winery on the estate. The first vintage was 2001, and the wines have become Oregon favorites. The Hammonds bottle three wines, Le Sud from the south 1 acre, Le Nord from the north 1 acre, and Joy de Vivre, meaning joy of life, a reserve wine made from the best barrels in the winery. The quantities produced are minuscule, the demand is high, and the wines are only sold through a mailing list, which I believe is now full. We tasted the 2004 Privé Vineyard Joy de Vivre, Willamette Valley Pinot Noir, 13.0% alcohol, 98 bottles produced, $85 in an etched bottle. This wine is the lightest in color and lightest in weight in the lineup. Upon pouring, the nose offers grass and herbs along with black cherry fruit. With time, roasted coffee aromas develop, which carry over into the flavors, which also include ripe red stone fruits, savory herbs, and a hint of mocha. Medium weighted, this Pinot has commendable balance and a clean finish. Excellent wine. The next producer is Rivers Marie. That's Rivers-Marie, M-A-R-I-E. Thomas Rivers Brown and his wife Genevieve Marie Walsh have quietly developed one of California's most cherished Pinot Noir labels. Thomas hails from South Carolina, was educated at the University of Virginia. He majored in English, literature, and game theory, two subjects which are about as distant from enology as possible. He decided he wanted to get in the wine business. He arrived in California in 1996. He had no leads, no connections. He started knocking on doors, and finally Aaron Jordan hired him at Turley. This was to become a fortuitous hire, as Aaron subsequently introduced Thomas to Scott and Joan Zeller, the owners of the 6-acre Suma Vineyard in the Occidental region of the true Sonoma coast. Early on, Suma Vineyard was the only source of Pinot Noir for Thomas, but led to other grape acquisitions in the area. Today, Rivers Marie produces very small amounts of Pinot Noir from 3 vineyard sources in the true Sonoma coast, specifically the Occidental Freestone area. Total production in 2007 is 650 cases. It's no wonder there are 4,000 people on the waiting list, hopelessly bidding their time for a spot on the mailing list. Managing allocations is a lot more difficult than crafting the wines. I think your best bet for trying these wines is to get them on the secondary market. And they're not terribly priced in the secondary market, in the $80 range. We tasted the 2006 Rivers Marie Occidental Ridge Vineyard Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir, 14.2% alcohol, 140 cases, priced at $40. Pie spice, black cherries, and cola. Complimentary citrus note adds zip and zing to the finish. All silk and satin with an appealing elegance unique among this lineup of wines that we tasted. We thought that this wine would match much better with food than many of the heavyweight cult wines because of its lively acidity. The next producer was Rocco, R-O-C-O. In 1987, Roland Soles hatched the Argaugh Winery, and the same year he purchased the hillside property in the Chehalem Mountains. It was many years later in 2001 that Roland and his wife Corby planted a 7-acre Pinot Noir vineyard on the property and named it Wits End Vineyard. The vines are planted at a very high density, and 3 Dijon clones make up the mix. The vines are lovingly cared for by Roland and his wife. Beginning in 2003, they produced 4 barrels of Pinot Noir meant for family and friends under the Rocco label and called it Private Stash. Beginning in 2004, Souls crafted 2 Pinot Noirs, a Rocco Willamette Valley bottling and the Rocco Private Stash. A small amount of the wines has been released to the public each vintage since then. We tasted the 2005 Private Stash Willamette Valley Pinot Noir, 14.5% alcohol, $75, in a screw cap bottle. Wow, this was brilliantly crafted. The balance was pinpoint. It had a complex perfume of confected black cherries and berries, exotic flowers, and understated charred oak. The wine picked up steam with exposure to air, broadening the nose and intensifying it. There was a rich arsenal of dark Pinot fruits with great purity and vigor, a clean finish with lively clarity. This had it all. This was really a complete wine and one of the top wines tasted. The next winery is Sea Smoke Cellars. Proprietor Bob Davids bought 350 acres of the Rancho Chabuchu in the western end of the Santa Rita Hills Appalachian in 1998. The next year, 100 of these acres were planted primarily to Pinot Noir with a small block of Chardonnay. The vineyards receive plenty of midday sun exposure, and the evenings are blessed with maritime fog, the so-called sea smoke and origin of the label's name. The estate vineyards overlook Fiddlestick Vineyard and further south the Sanford and Benedict Vineyard. There are 10 clones of Pinot Noir planted. The first winemaker, beginning with the 2001 vintage, was Chris Curran, who this year left to work at Foley Estates. There are 3 bottlings of Pinot Noir, Botella, Salving, and Tin. The wines are sold almost exclusively through a mailing list with some availability on the secondary market. We tasted the 2002 Sea Smoke 10 Santa Rita Hills Pinot Noir, 14.5% alcohol. Current retail price is $225 to $300. This was the inaugural release of Sea Smoke 10, which is composed of all 10 clones planted on the estate. This is a pretty good wine, not exceptional. There was plenty of confected fruit with aggressive oak, hints of raisin, a little bit of overripeness. It was very soft and smooth, and the tannins were quite fine. And the finish was pleasant and dry. It was decent wine, but not of cult quality. The final producer we tasted was City Quinan. This is a tiny producer in one of California's really true cult wineries. Established in 1994 in Ventura, California by ex-restaurateur Manfred Krankel and his wife Elaine, the wines have brought raves from the wine press, and the mailing list has long ago filled up, with hundreds of names lingering on the waiting list. The wines are unique because each is assigned a different name for each vintage. The labels feature unusual label artwork done by Krankel himself, and he uses wildly different bottle shapes for each wine. Actually, each bottle is really an impressive work of art. Krankel made 8 vintages of Pinot Noir from Shea Vineyard in Oregon, and 2 vintages of Pinot Noir in 2005 and 2006 from grapes sourced in the Santa Rita Hills. He then discontinued his Pinot Noir program to concentrate on Rhone varietals. If you're interested in more information, there's a very informative interview of Manfred Krankel posted on Grape Radio. As far as getting the wines, well, you have to go on to the secondary market and be prepared to open your wallet. We tasted 2 sine qua non wines. They are quintessential, what I call Nuevo California Pinot Noir, with plenty of ripe fruit extraction, generous alcohol, and seductive texture. They're not for the faint of heart, and they're really unlike anything from the old world. The 2004 Sine Qua Non Covert Finger Santa Rita Hills Pinot Noir comes in at 14.9% alcohol, current retail price, $245 to $450. This is a powerful wine. Black raspberry, blackberry perfume practically knocks you over. It's huge, jammy, powerful black fruits that are very flashy. It's rather linear and lacking nuances, but oh, what a ride. This is really a hedonist wine. The other wine we tasted was the 2002 sine qua non Hollerin M Shea Vineyard Willamette Valley Pinot Noir. This comes in at 15.4% alcohol with a current secondary market price of $345 to $500. I've had this wine actually on three occasions over the past few years, and it has always impressed me. A haunting nose of exotic dark berries with oak, musk, earth, charcoal, minerals, and a little bit of alcohol. Brassy dark velvet fruit that is rich, flamboyant, and sumptuous. The tannins are suede-like, and the wine caresses the tongue like a fur coat. If you can imagine having a fur coat around your tongue. Easy for me to imagine. My only complaint is that you can't drink much of it at one sitting because of the alcohol. So this was quite an experience, quite a nice lineup of wines to taste at one sitting. I know some people decry the idea of putting wines into competition and comparing them, but I think these are all wines that are quite distinctive. And there wasn't a lot of comparison going on, but rather critiquing enjoying the wines for what they were. And it was quite a nice experience, probably a once-in-a-lifetime experience, because it'll be quite a few years before I'll be able to accumulate a similar lineup. But hopefully down the road, I'll do it again. So that's enough for today. This is Rusty Gaffney. Thanks for listening. And check you next time.